bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't care. I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast, powered by FanDuel Sportsbook, NFL Week 7, Monday Night Football Edition. I'm your host, Todd Furman, joined, as always, by my esteemed colleague and co-host, the one, the only, Payne Insider. Perfect time to remind you, FanDuel.com/BetTheBoard, all sorts of great sign-up incentives for you there, $1,000 risk-free bets, enhanced odds, you name it, plenty of ways to get yourself in on the mix. Payne, another week of NFL football in the rearview mirror, and another laundry list of coaching performances that aren't going to have their teams in a great spot going forward.
No, it was an interesting weekend, I think. Overall, not the best for us, that's for sure. I enjoyed coming on this podcast 2 weeks ago much better on a Monday than I am right now. I'm not really sure what we've seen from some of these teams. It's really bizarre, especially in the AFC landscape, when you're looking at the Bengals in first place, the Titans in first place, the Raiders in first place. I don't think anyone saw that coming at this point in the season through 7 weeks.
You mean you weren't counting the days down until Raiders-Bengals out here in Las Vegas is a potential showdown amongst two of the elite teams in the AFC going into the season?
I did not. That would be interesting if somehow, and it's not going to happen, but it would be interesting to see Vegas host playoff games. I think that will be interesting for that city just based upon how well they turned out for the hockey team.
It's been a pretty incredible buzz so far for the Raiders, despite having a ton of visiting fans coming in, week out. I mean, there were a lot of Philly fans here for yesterday's game. Of course, Philly gets out to that 7-0 lead, and it's all Raiders from there going forward. But there's no doubt we see it every year in the National Football League, whether it's a Super Bowl hangover that's plaguing Kansas City or the worst to first that we're seeing in the AFC North. So many things to be excited about and paying. I think talking about the Bengals, it makes an awful lot of sense. Are there strong enough words that we can say about what kind of impact Ja'Marr Chase has had just through 7 games? The rookie out of LSU kind of taking the league by storm.
Ja'Marr Chase has been awesome. I think you're also seeing the maturation of Joe Burrow. That's a guy who's all we were looking for was confidence back post-knee injury, and that seems to be what's transpiring. It's a lot of weapons. I mean, you'd have to go down, and the only team that comes to mind right now would be Tampa Bay in terms of having a better collective receiver group. And then you have CJ Uzma, who's just like, they finally figured out, at least this staff, that guy's a playmaker. But looking at yesterday's game, I watched the whole thing, and the Bengals were solid in just about every area, total team effort. But Chase and Burrow, completely unstoppable. Burrow's completion percentage, 9% better than expectation. Ja'Marr Chase owned Marlon Humphrey, one of the league's best corners. That was shocking to me. In that matchup alone, Ja'Marr Chase had 5 catches, 165 yards. Every single one of those catches went for either a touchdown or a first down on Humphrey. Probably Marlon Humphrey's worst game in the NFL. He was getting toasted by CJ Uzma, 55-yard touchdown. I mean, that's one where you're like, hey, we have Marlon Humphrey on a tight end here. And he just got abused. And it wasn't just the physicality. It was a great route run, cut back. I mean, Marlon Humphrey gave up over 200 yards in coverage yesterday. Just mind-boggling. And I think the one difference that we saw back-to-back weeks, right, where Baltimore was able to shut down a Chargers offense, the difference in those two offenses from the Chargers and the Bengals, where the Bengals wanted to spread you out, and that forces you to kind of tip your hand defensively a little bit more, whereas the Chargers were going bunch, and you could have a Baltimore defense kind of live in the box and in the middle of the field, and you didn't know whether it was blitz coming, whether they're dropping back in coverage. That was kind of the difference in those two offenses, and obviously spreading Baltimore out a little bit more defensively and making them identify what they were going to do led to some of the explosive Cincinnati had.
You know, one of the big knocks on the Ravens coming in to this week, and we've seen it plague them all season long, has been tackling. That, again, was on full display with shorter gains turning into significantly longer ones. The Jamar Chase run and catch, run after the catch really comes to mind. Is that something that Baltimore can get figured out, or do we think this is more an anomaly that Wink Martindale's defense is dealing with early on in the season?
Well, they like to play man coverage. Right. So a lot of that is, if there is going to be a completion, it is on that one guy to figure out how to bring the opponent down. And so you are going to naturally see more broken tackles in those scenarios when guys are playing man and living on islands. It's fundamental football, right? So like, I don't know what there is to do or say or fix other than like you go back into the lab and you're like, hey, we just need to work on fundamentals here. So
yep.
That's that situation. But in general, right, when you play man, when you give up a catch, it's just you and that guy.
Yep.
And so
got to make you know, plays in space. There is no doubt about it. As that game kind of took off, we saw a very defensive minded approach early on in the contest get slightly more offensive. And of course, the Ravens offense was not able to keep up. Along with the good we saw from the Bengals, as we do here every Monday morning, pain, the good, the bad, and the ugly. What else really stood out to you in a positive direction yesterday afternoon?
I think you actually have to give Frank Reich and Carson Wentz some credit. And those two seem to be on the same wavelength. We knew they were great friends and they had more in common than just football. Now, the Colts obviously still have some holes, but speaking specifically about Wentz and Reich and that relationship, I think it's going pretty well. Carson Wentz appears reprogrammed, so to speak. And you can make the case that part of the slow start to the season was a byproduct of the broken foot and not getting acclimated to the new offense and new players. There's also been issues in front of Wentz with the O-line. But you put all the things together that we've seen this season with the injury and everything that I just mentioned, Wentz right now is playing at an above average quarterback rate. And I thought yesterday, in that kind of weather, with a slick ball, Wentz was pretty accurate. He was willing to push the ball downfield, something the 49ers couldn't do. And we can say, like, hey, it was a lot of pass interference calls. Most of them were pretty spot on. And at least they understood that that was going to be a part of their game plan, knowing that it was a slick surface. They were at least willing to push the ball down the field. San Francisco was not. I think what was interesting was his ability also as a runner in that game, something Jimmy G simply wasn't going to add, right? That's not a dynamic that Jimmy G gives your offense. Wentz added some pretty timely runs, right? You had the touchdown. You had the crucial second and 15 explosive run that turned a drive that was likely a punt situation into a field goal attempt. That was pretty good, responding to the 49ers, cutting it to two. I actually, this morning, right before we hopped on the podcast, I made an adjustment to my Colts power rating because I gave Carson Wentz an uptick. He is clearly better than the quarterback I thought he was coming into the season. And again, you could have made the case that even his MVP season was quite fluky when you looked at all the third down completion rates and some of the fourth down completion rates, stuff that was not predictable, stuff that was unsustainable. And so I made a pretty nice uptick for Carson Wentz this morning and now have the Colts 1 point better than an average team.
Hey, it's an impressive win to go on the road. We know the Colts took a ton of money from professional bettors. That number drove closer to three, along with under money coming in as well. Total as high as 44.5, 45 early in the week. Mother Nature played a role. Game squeaks over the total with that explosive pass play to Michael Pittman when the Colts were up 23-18. Payne, do we have to start heaping praise on Mike Vrabel and the Tennessee Titans? Arguably the most impressive week an NFL team has had in the span of 6 days. They pull off two upsets in their own building. One against the Buffalo Bills, 34-31 last Monday night, and of course followed up with a dominant defensive performance against the Chiefs team that clearly has a myriad of issues they need to address. But regardless, 27-3 in your own building has to open some eyes.
what 6 days will do to a team. I mean, the defense had stunk, the offense had regressed, and no one really knew what was going on in Tennessee. The Julio Jones trade wasn't really coming to fruition. That just, you know, there was no impact. And so you were left searching for answers, right? You let your tight end room walk. You're getting no production out of that unit. Your left tackle went down in a scary situation on Monday night. Everything 6 days ago looked terrible for Tennessee. And now you are leaders in the AFC. The game was over by halftime. I stopped watching.
That game was over by the end of the first quarter.
At that point.
End of the first quarter. Let's not even say halftime.
You know, I'm going to say halftime. But, I mean, I have no idea what I really watched. I mean, I think everyone came into the game wondering, like, how on earth would the second worst run defense in the NFL stop Derrick Henry? Well, they did. Right? Tennessee ran the ball 21 times in the first half, averaged 3.1 a carry, only had one explosive run. They did exactly what no one thought they could do. And somehow, we got the pass game from Ryan Tannehill that we hadn't seen the first six games, really. They came on late in the Buffalo game, scored on their final six drives. That carried over. Tannehill was basically untouchable in the first half. 67% passing success rate, four explosive passes, 10.1 yards an attempt in the first half. And we talked about the Chiefs struggling to defend play-action passes. The only reason those metrics look and appear that the Chiefs survived is because of an interception. But if you just look at play-action passes, Tannehill, 91% adjusted completion percentage. They had him throw with play-action on 40% of his dropbacks. The ball that he put down the sideline on 3rd and 10 to A.J. Brown was probably one of the better throws of the entire weekend. And that was what was just bizarre about the first half of that game is, again, like, Derrick Henry couldn't do a damn thing. Chiefs run defense was phenomenal. But you had a 3rd and 9 screen pass where you had the Titans backed up inside their own five somehow convert. You rarely see the screen pass from your own end zone, but that's what we got. And then you had the big 3rd and 10 conversion to A.J. Brown, and suddenly the Chiefs just couldn't get off the field. It was a really bizarre game to watch, honestly.
You know, that game, watching it, and of course it's not quite apples to apples, reminded me quite a bit of a game we saw the Titans involved in last year where they were on the wrong end of the stick. Cleveland Browns go in there, and everyone thinks they're going to run the football right over and through them. Baker Mayfield has arguably one of his best passing games, and that one was over by halftime with the Browns offensive explosion. It almost had that same look and feel of Tennessee breaking tendency and obviously reaping massive benefits and upside.
Yeah, I mean, there was early on in the week, based upon how the Bills game ended, you weren't sure if Julio Jones was going to play. We assumed that A.J. Brown would still be on that snap restriction, although that seems to be getting lifted a little bit.
Yeah, week 10. Like week there. 10, allegedly, right? Yeah,
week
10, huh?
My foot. Yeah. So, I mean, the pass game was interesting. You know, you had some trick plays. You had Pruitt get involved over the middle, which is where you really want to attack the Chiefs defense. You want to kind of make their linebackers play in coverage a little bit. And you saw linebackers that were really aggressive, right? There's a number of times where Bolton was run blitzing and stuffing Henry behind the line of scrimmage, but you kind of use that aggressiveness against him in certain situations with the play action pass. Ultimately, I think the stunning part was, you know, what the defense did. I think that was probably the biggest shocker, but the offense certainly did enough in the first half to build a lead.
All right, well, we stay on that game. I mean, I'm sure there's some other good things that are worth highlighting, so I don't want to completely neglect that. Do you want to make the segue into what's going on with Kansas City at this point, or did you want to highlight some of the other positives that we saw kind of unfold throughout the course of Week 7 thus far?
No, I think we just keep right here, and we kind of transition to the bad of the weekend, and we can start with Kansas City if you'd like. Listen, it's the NFL, right? 18 games. It's a really small sample size sport, and every week there is a head scratcher, and this was Week 7's head scratcher. I just, you know, the Titans defense without its best players in the secondary, shutting down Patrick Mahomes and the Chiefs offense is something no one expected. Even if you loved the Titans in this matchup, No one saw 3 points coming. There was game day steam from a really respected group that went over 57. And it's why the total closed 59. It even touched 60 at one point. And the Chiefs went out 3.9 yards per play in the first half. And as it stands, Mahomes right now, completion percentage, 9% below expectation. That was the worst of week 7 thus far, obviously. You know, you have Jameis and Geno going tonight. There's potential that one of those two might eclipse Mahomes' performance.
How dare you? How dare you talk about Jameis that way?
The worst of the week was Mahomes. So I have no clue what's going on with the Chiefs as a whole and if things are fixable. But right now you have a Chiefs offense that's a little beat up, that's not quite adapting to how teams are playing them, and some of the studs are playing banged up. And then defensively, going back to what we discussed a few moments ago, you kind of get the inverse performance where everyone's yelling how you can't stop the run, and the Chiefs were great doing that, but suddenly the secondary, which is the strength, which is how this team is built, right? It was, we're going to play with leads, and then we need to be able to defend the pass as teams play catch-up. The secondary was not very good. They couldn't get off the field on third down. 67% success rate on third and fourth down for the Titans. I just, again, you had screen passes on third and nine backed up in your own end, couldn't get off the field. You know, that A.J. Brown pass, or catch rather, was phenomenal. And we really, to this point, Todd, through 7 weeks, have not seen a game for the Chiefs where everything is working simultaneously. There's always an issue. And this week, the issue was offense, which I didn't think anyone saw coming.
Yeah, I mean, this is an offense, honestly, that if you dig into some of the numbers, had 138 yards through 2.5 quarters, had run 17 plays on offense the entire first half, compared to 23 for the Tennessee Titans. It just looked like they were out of sync from start to finish, and you kept going, oh, well, it's 14-0 Tennessee, Kansas City scores here. This is going to be a game for a lot of the reasons that you outlined there, talking that this was expected to be one of the highest scoring games, not just of Week 7, but of the entire season, given where the total closed, and it never lived up to those expectations. Kansas City was unable to get things going in the second half, mustering a grand total of 3 points. They did pitch a shutout in a game that I guess was a comfortable second half under at 28.5, had you had the foresight to go under there. Baltimore, Payne, when you look at the Ravens, we've talked at great lengths about Lamar being a much better deep passer, clearly has his weapons on the field in the likes of Rashad Bateman, Hollywood Brown, Mark Andrews. But for me, it's starting to become a problem with this Ravens ground game. You look at the productivity from players not named Lamar Jackson. Devontae Freeman, 4 carries, 14 yards. Tyson Williams, 2 carries, 10 yards. Le'Veon Bell, 5 carries, 5 yards. The longest run from that trio of aging running backs, a grand total of 10 yards. When should we begin to get concerned about what Baltimore doesn't have as far as productivity from the running back position?
Yeah, I don't think this is anything really new, especially if you are a loyal listener. I mean, outside of Lamar Jackson, the Ravens' run game has been a zero. Latavius Murray has done okay, but he was out. And then after randomly benching Tyson Williams, you've lost that kid's confidence. And now you try to go back to him. It's tough. Devontae Freeman and Le'Veon Bell don't belong in the league. 19 yards on 9 carries for those two gentlemen. And Bell still thinks he can get to the outside. That was fun watching that 4-yard loss where he like took the or he was like lined up on the right side of Lamar Jackson and took a running play across the face of the offensive line and tried getting outside, and I think a linebacker got to him. Now, it wasn't even like a safety or a corner, which you would expect, but a linebacker beat him to the spot. It was just, you know, that is not a great combination. Now, I will say this. Let's give some credit where it's due, right? We praise the Bengals offense, but let's not forget about the defense. I thought yesterday was a total team effort. You know, you look at what the Ravens did offensively, 5.5 yards a play, 41% success rate. Lamar Jackson wasn't really effective in the pass game either. 9% below expectation. Things probably would have been a lot more bleak had Hollywood Brown not made that ridiculous catch, one of the better catches of the entire NFL week. But they're not getting anything out of the run game right now. Let's see what it looks like when Latavius Murray comes back. But fundamentally, that's kind of changed. This is what teams are doing now. And I know Lamar was a little bit more effective on the ground. Not a terrible day running yesterday for Lamar individually. But what you have are teams that are going to force Lamar to hand the ball off. And when you don't have a weapon at running back, that's all teams are going to do. That is the smart thing to do, right? Have your ends crash down and force Lamar to hand it off to one of the running backs. And the offensive line over the years have started to downgrade a little bit. And then you got unfortunate news this past week that looks like Ronnie Stanley is now out again for the entire season. You did get Tyree Phillips back, but then Ben Cleveland went down. So the offensive line is downgraded in talent, and it hasn't been the healthiest over the last few years. So you kind of see this trickling down, and then your hope was like you have a young back and Dobbs, and he goes out. It just, there's not a ton of great options in the run game right now. I think Tyson Williams is certainly the most dynamic. This should be a two-headed system where that's fine if you want to give Latavius Murray some carries, especially around the goal line or in short yardage. But this should be primarily a Murray-Tyson Williams backfield, and it's not right now.
You would think that's the case because when you look at Lamar, you're right. I mean, those rushing yards definitely gave them some balance, but none of them appeared, at least to me, to really come from design running plays. It was more him scrambling, trying to extend plays, and really going out there to try and show a little bit of balance in the box score. That was slightly misleading. Speaking of misleading, Payne, I'm not sure if we give the Green Bay Packers defense credit for being opportunistic or we absolutely eviscerate the Washington football team, who felt like they played the entire game, not only in Green Bay territory, but in Green Bay's red zone, and had drives that look like this. Your opening drive results in a touchdown. Your second drive of the game, 5 plays, 39 yards, missed field goal. 5 plays, 45 yards, short on downs, end of the half. You fumble on your opening drive of the second half. Then you're short on downs in Green Bay territory once, twice, intercepted, field goal. I mean, Washington had plenty of opportunities, not only to cover that game as more than a touchdown underdog, but to maybe have a chance to win outright, given that that was arguably the best defensive performance we'd seen from Washington so far this season.
It's a really bizarre game. And that's kind of how I will phrase that. And I somehow got stuck watching that game. I just kept getting just pulled in. The under was very sharp. Came in, I want to say, towards the latter part of the week at like 49.5. So it didn't stun me that this was kind of what we got. And we expected a little bit of a flat spot from Green Bay. Offensively, the Packers were not great. You hit that perfectly. Finally, Washington's defense showed up. They were able to get some pressure on Aaron Rodgers. Passed the 4th-and-3 conversion to Adams. He didn't have the greatest of days. You'll live with what he provided offensively as a defense past that touchdown. I don't know what to make, right? Because you look at this and you're like, oh my God, Washington was a net plus 8% in success rate, and they outgained Green Bay by half a yard per play. And certainly that was a game where they should have covered. But you'll watch it, and it's just bizarre to see unfold, right? Like, sure, it's the interception in the end zone. I mean, he threw it right to the guy. I mean, it wasn't anything, like, lucky or fluky
about it. Yeah, that was not Taylor Heinicke's best toss of the game. That's for sure.
No, right. And then it's like, what is he doing? You can walk into the end zone for a touchdown, and he slides in and gives himself up. It's like, you know, just there's not a lot of weapons there. Most of the offense was like this unscripted. Like, Taylor Heinicke had almost 100 yards rushing yesterday, all of which were basically unscripted. He was extending drives with his legs, and it's a very bad, very bad Green Bay defense that was without some of its best players. Right, Preston was out. You're still dealing with Jair out. A lot of guys are out. They've also, I won't get too far ahead, but when we discussed Thursday night, one of the talking points will clearly be the offenses that Green Bay has faced. They're very bad defense, and they have faced pretty much nobody. So that wasn't overly shocking to see Washington have some success offensively, but it was weird success, right? It was just very, very bizarre. And you could see in those situations that you mentioned, some of those critical, like 4th-and-2, like 3rd-and, like medium, let's extend the drive. They just don't have any playmakers. It's Terry McLaurin. That's it. And so it was just a bizarre game to watch. And I completely agree with you. Washington certainly deserved better. Don't know if they would have won the game, but certainly should have covered.
Yeah, incredible to watch that game. And of course, you're going to get uneven performances from both sides. Green Bay continues to do what they've done all season long at home, cover numbers, and get folks there on Moneyline Parlays, teasers as well. If Washington's offense was bad, Payne, I'm not sure calling Carolina's offense bad does them justice. I feel like they need to fall into a different bucket entirely of their own choosing, and that, of course, would be the ugly variety. Sam Darnold benched in favor of P.J. Walker. P.J. Walker, what does he do? Comes in relief, 3 of 14 as the game got away from Carolina after an opening drive field goal. Ran the ball for a grand total of 56 yards on 17 carries. Clearly, something is broken in Charlotte, and it can't just be entirely CMC's absence.
Not the return to New York Sam Darnold was hoping for, I'm sure. 4.4 yards an attempt, 39% passing success rate, completion percentage 7% below expectation. It's not just Sam Darnold, though. You know, obviously, he's still making like the head-scratching throw from time to time. And defenses have figured out how to defend the Panthers' only weapon right now in DJ Moore. It's clear. You mentioned CMC, right? Like, life without him is not the same, clearly. Sam Darnold is struggling. Joe Brady is struggling. Robbie Anderson has been a total zero, leads the league in drops. And I think we knew coming into the season the Panthers' offensive line was one of the worst in football. And right now, they're 30th in pass block win rate. Only the Texans and Dolphins are worse, bottom third in the NFL in line yards created. So you have an offensive line that's not getting push with a rookie running back that is not as good as CMC, obviously. And then you can't really keep Sam Darnold clean. And you mentioned P.J. Walker coming in, who's probably in the league because of a relationship. And he somehow managed to play worse than Sam Darnold by a long mile. So much so that Matt Rhule immediately scrambled to say, Sam Darnold's our starting quarterback in the postgame presser.
Poor Panthers.
You'd never seen anyone talk about Sam Darnold more glowingly and more confidently than probably his high school coaches and the USC staff who recruited him. No one's talked that glowingly about Sam Darnold, especially after that type of performance. Matt Rhule, my thought process was he was hoping to strike lightning there with P.J. Walker, his old buddy from Temple, and that just did not happen. And so now all of a sudden the race for Deshaun Watson gets a little bit more interesting. We'll see if Carolina goes back in and re-ups their offer. Right now the Dolphins do have the best offer on the table for Deshaun Watson, and Deshaun Watson prefers Miami, and Deshaun Watson has a no-trade clause, so he gets to pick his destination effectively. He is discussed being willing to go to multiple places, but it'll be interesting to see if after that performance from Sam Darnold gets the Panthers organization to up their ante. Obviously, they've already spent a bunch, right? Going and getting a Stephon Gilmore, going and getting a CJ Henderson. Now, all of a sudden, you're tripling back down and trying to get your franchise quarterback, but it's probably still worth it at this point when you have a young head coach and offensive coordinator.
Yeah, you never thought the Houston Texans losing to the Arizona Cardinals 31-5 was actually going to be a win because of what unfolded in both Miami and Carolina over the weekend as far as Deshaun Watson and a potential landing spot. Should a deal get done before the trade deadline that inches ever so close. But as far as Sam Darnold, he may still have had last laugh given what his former team was able to accomplish. In New England, coming in off a bye, no CJ Mosley, the defense looked absolutely lost. They allowed almost 8 yards per play and 550 yards to the Patriots. Mac Jones probably had flashbacks to his Alabama days playing against SEC lightweights given what he did against the gangrene defense.
Not the effort you're looking for off the bye against a familiar opponent. You know, I'm envisioning the bye week a little bit, and Robert Saleh, between multiple jumping chest bumps last week, I'm sure was telling his guys, like, this is the start of the new season, baby. Like, everything else is in the past. We're starting the new season fresh out of the bye, 0-0. And then Mac Jones and the Patriots offense just smacks his Jets defense around for four quarters. And 551 yards on a Robert Saleh defense that had 2 weeks to prepare for an offense that played a month ago. It's just, when you start to kind of put it in context, it's very laughable. New England, as you mentioned, almost 8 yards per play. They had 17 explosive plays in the game, whether it was running or passing. Jets defense had no answers. Mac Jones was fantastic. We're starting to see him grow a little bit. Completion percentage nearly 4% better than expectation. He did a very good job spreading the ball around. 11 different players had receptions. Even with CJ Mosley out, who, yes, is the quarterback of the defense, this was inexcusable. The Jets literally had 2 weeks to prepare for a team they played in week two, and your head coach is a defensive-minded coach.
Not great.
Unbelievable.
Not great. Not great at all.
I don't know what you do. I mean, I like Joe Douglas, and I think he's made some good moves personnel-wise. This was not my choice for head coach. It just wasn't. I didn't get it. I didn't understand it. I thought the 49ers defense regressed, especially in the back half once Joe Woods left for Cleveland. I'm not into all the rah-rah cheerleader type stuff. There's a reason we have cheerleaders. I don't want my defensive coordinator head coach being one. I'm sure he's a fine guy. A lot of people like him, and it's very early in his tenure. We're not going to bury the guy after 7 games. But his defense is not good. And even when you are talent void, there are still things within your scheme that you can do to prevent big plays. And he's not even doing that. And so it's very interesting to see what this Jets team has as a head coach. Obviously, the quarterback can change an entire organization. We're seeing that firsthand with Joe Burrow. And I'm not sure Zach Wilson's that guy. But not a ton of sophistication going on for the Jets on either side of the ball right now.
Yeah, and you mentioned Joe Burrow and what he's been able to do to the Bengals franchise compared to Zach Wilson, who are still not sure exactly the severity of his knee injury. Those two teams will do battle. We'll get to some of those look-ahead adjustments in just a second. But wanted to remind all of you, you can follow Payne on Twitter, at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there. Most importantly, follow the podcast, at Bet the Board Pod. And Payne, before we transition completely into some of the look-ahead lines and ongoing odds-maker adjustments, were there any things that you wanted to hit on, whether they fell into the good, the bad, or the ugly category for week 7?
No, I think we can transition ahead. Obviously, I watched a bunch of the Dolphins game. I don't think Tua is done in this league. I really don't. I mean, he's very accurate. He's just got to figure out how to eliminate some of the mistakes, got to grow in confidence a little bit. Ultimately, we'll see where he lands. You know, my understanding was last week that trade was at the 1 yard line. And then there was some potential possibilities where a third team was going to be involved. That third team was speculated to be Washington. And so I know the Dolphins are certainly trying to use Tua as part of the package so they don't have to give up other picks. So I don't know what the deal will look like, if it's two teams, if it's three teams, if it's the Dolphins, or if suddenly Carolina just goes bananas and ups their package. But I don't think Tua is done in this league. He's just got to stay healthy. He's got to be available. And he's got to work on a couple things. That interception in the second half was about as bad as it gets. I mean, completely changed the complex of that game, the complexion of that game. And, you know, you had Xavier Howard make a ridiculous interception in a one-score game, and you're thinking, oh, Dolphins are lined up here. And instead, the interception by Tua was so bad that it becomes this potential 14-point swing late in the game. And without those two interceptions, the Dolphins win that game outright. And so you can look at the numbers and be like, whew, Tua was awesome, right? 4 touchdown passes. Completion percentage was fantastic on the season. Tua's got a completion percentage 2% above expectation. It's just some of the head-scratching interceptions that he's throwing right now. And we started to see that a little bit at Alabama from time to time.
Yeah, that was the one thing when he couldn't have the huge talent mismatches on the outside, whether he was throwing receivers open or some questionable decision-making. We'll see if he can get that corrected. You know, whether it's as the starting quarterback in Miami or should he land somewhere else, either before the trade deadline or shortly thereafter. When we look at some of the ongoing adjustments throughout the marketplace, Payne, I think this one obviously makes a ton of sense. The Jets-Bengals game, the Bengals at FanDuel Sportsbook were a 4.5-point favorite for their Week 8 trip to MetLife Stadium to take on the Jets. Very disparate results for the two teams, and the Bengals have ballooned out to an 8.5-point chalk.
Actually, out to 10 as we are recording this right now.
Good call.
You're looking right now. I mean, you mentioned the wildly contrasting results, and that's part of this. You know, you have a Bengals team go out and win by 3+ scores on the road as a touchdown dog. The Jets off a bye get 50 hung on them as a 7-point dog. And then you do sprinkle in a little bit of the potential downgrade from Zach Wilson to Mike White, and this is how you get to 10. Now, the line is certainly inflated, and you won't have some of the focus from the Bengals I wouldn't envision. But this will come down to explosives. Jets, as I alluded to, gave up 17 last week. They're one of the worst explosive pass defenses in the league. And the Bengals' offense, that was just 19th in efficiency coming into last week, had pretty much survived on the explosive pass. So if somehow you can figure out how to negate some of the big plays from Cincinnati, it will be difficult to cover an inflated spread of 10 on the road. That's just a little interesting. I'm not sure where we go from here in terms of this line. Does it make another move if Zach Wilson is announced out? Mike White's the backup quarterback, and obviously Zach Wilson's no great shakes right now. It's still about a 1.5-point adjustment downwards.
Yeah, it might be a bigger indictment of where Mike White is in the Jets quarterback situation overall if they don't have a savvy veteran to sit and fill in.
Is he the Western Kentucky kid?
Yeah, I want to say South Florida first and then Western Kentucky. Okay. I can't even remember his exact progression. But yeah, he did finish up his career at Western Kentucky. You are correct in that regard. Philadelphia and Detroit. The Eagles were a 4-point favorite on a look ahead. We talked a little bit about some of their defensive struggles for their trip out here against Vegas. Detroit goes out there, treats the game like the Super Bowl, and to their credit, played extremely well in the grand scheme of things. All sorts of trick plays, a onside kick, fake punts, you name it, to try and do everything they could to get exactly a measure of revenge for Jared Goff. But that number goes from Philadelphia -4 on the road to Philadelphia, now a 3-point road favorite.
Again, you have contrasting results. And really what's bizarre to me is we had questions about the Eagles coaching staff coming into the season, right? Sirianni was like their 8th choice, and management wanted guys that they could kind of treat as chess pieces as opposed to a coach that was willing to do things on his own and take a stand and have a little bit more control of the team. What we're seeing right now is the Eagles not really showing an ability to adapt. You know, like I watched yesterday's game and somehow the defense was not able to stop the run. It kind of had been a problem early on in the season, but you had a secondary also that had done well preventing explosives. But all of a sudden, this week especially, it was nothing but the short passing game. And there was, again, no like in-game adjustment. We're just going to let Derek Carr throw to Hunter Renfrey for like 4 yards a pop, 6 yards a pop, 7 yards a pop. We were going to let Henry Ruggs catch balls for 8 yards a pop, 9 yards a pop. Like, there was just no adjustments made at all on either side of the ball. It was really wild. And so you kind of bring that forward to this week against Detroit, and Detroit is a short passing game. You can't allow them to paper cut you to death like the Raiders did. The Eagles' offense is certainly worse than it appears on the surface, I think, especially if you're kind of just looking at the middle two quarters from what I have seen, and I haven't done the necessary deep dive into this. My eyes told me something, and then I did a very cursory kind of exploring into this theory that I have. But basically, you have two types of offenses for the Eagles. It's the script and the catch-up offense in the first and fourth quarter, and then you have the Eagles' actual offense in the second and third quarter after the script wears off and before the game is out of hand and the opponent's playing prevent. Again, I haven't spent enough time with this, but really you're looking at an Eagles offense if you kind of remove the script and the fourth quarter catch-up, we're down by double digits offense. You go from like an average offense to one of the league's worst. And so that's kind of tough to explore yesterday. The problem was the middle eight again. You come out with a great script. You score. Awesome. The Raiders do respond, but you have that. It's 7-7, right? And you're kind of in that final 5, 6, 7 minutes of the second quarter, and you can kind of regain that momentum. And I believe it was, Todd, a third and three from the Raiders 40. And you're saying, oh, this is an analytically sound organization. Two downs to get 3 yards. Not a problem. And then your offensive lineman jumps off sides. It's third and eight. And then the Raiders can pin their ears back and use their advantage of the pass rush. And you sack a quarterback. And then all of a sudden you punt it and you pin, and the Raiders go on a 96-yard drive and get the momentum score before halftime. And you're like, shit, we gave up the momentum score. Let's see if we can rebound. And then Gainwell fumbles and then go and get another score before halftime. And so that's really been the issue for the Eagles, is like the middle stanzas, the second and third quarter. It's really tough to incorporate, but it's something that we certainly have to at this point.
Do you want to take a shot at the Eagles' decision to accept a penalty when the Raiders' punt team was coming onto the field from about midfield? Now, granted, the Eagles were able to force an interception on the Raiders' opening drive, but I wasn't sure if you wanted to get that off your chest as well.
So it's one thing to play the game by the books. And when you have a, I believe, what was it? That was a third and three. You get the stop, so it's now fourth and three, and there's a holding call. And I'm all for, you know, backing the team up. But there's got to be a general sense of what's going on around you. There's got to be a vibe for the game. And when you see the incomplete pass and the Raiders sprint off the field so quickly, like they wanted nothing to do with going for it, you don't then accept the penalty and allow them to pick up third and 13. And that's what the Eagles did. Fortunately, you're right. Early on, they had that deflection interception, or that decision would have been much maligned, even more than we're doing here on the Monday morning Bet the Board podcast, where we recap the week.
Yeah, and I mean, still, even with that being the case, yes, it doesn't result in points, but a Raiders drive starts at its 3-yard line on the deflected pick, where you never know, with a punt, maybe it's a touchback and you're starting your 20, so your play calling is going to look significantly different. It shifts field position, and either way, it sounds like Philadelphia has plenty of things they'll need to work out, to say the least. One of Philadelphia's division mates, the New York Giants, we probably didn't give them enough credit as we eviscerated Carolina. They get a dominant 25-3 win as a 3-point home underdog, a team that hasn't been great when it comes to covering numbers in their own building. They have been dynamic where it matters most at the betting window on the road. They see their number a 12.5-point price tag on the look ahead for a trip to Arrowhead in prime time. That number now down to 10.
Yes, and we're already seeing some 9.5 in the market. It's certainly trending that way a little bit. I don't know what to make of this one. There's nothing really to say here that isn't already obvious, right? You're a Chiefs team that survived on its offense for 6 weeks. And then you go out and hang 3 points on the road as a 4.5-point favorite. So you're going to get downgraded in that situation. And then some of the nagging injuries that are being kind of disguised and hidden by the Chiefs. And then you mentioned the Giants, who have played, I think, better than their record throughout the majority of this season. Could have easily won on the road at Washington earlier this season. You had a 7-point lead against an Atlanta team that's trending in the right direction at home in the fourth quarter, and you managed to lose that game as well. So I do believe the Giants are better than their record indicates, even with a slew of injuries. Yesterday was a very good performance. The defense stepped up. The offense did just enough. Got contributions from unlikely candidates like Dante Pettis. That was a guy who everyone was raving about as a route runner out of college, just couldn't stay healthy enough for the 49ers, but is making an impact the last 2 weeks on the Giants offense, filling in for a lot of those injured receivers. So that's basically what we're seeing here with this number. Not a massive adjustment when you talk about 2.5 points from 12.5 down to the 10. One game that will obviously break down a week from now.
No doubt about it. And I will say one final thing on Kansas City, not to pile on. You get it all the time in college football where a team is favored by a certain number and sometimes doesn't actually score that particular threshold. I believe Kansas City is the first team this season favored by more than a field goal that wasn't even able to muster enough points to get outside that number as they closed a 4-point favorite. We talked about them winning the game by 3. But on to Monday Night Football, where we have the Saints and the Seahawks to close things out for week 7. You're looking at New Orleans, a 4-point road favorite at FanDuel Sportsbook. Price has come down a touch from where it was over the weekend. Total has come down as well, as we're looking at a 41.5 here. It was as high as 43.5, 44. Jameis Winston, of course, hasn't exactly been great when it comes to lining people's wallets as a favorite. 7-16-1 against the spread overall. 3-10-1 against the spread in his career when favored by 3+ points. A loss for the Seahawks would drop their odds of making the playoffs well below 10%. So clearly a lot at stake. New Orleans, extra time to prepare. Seattle, second straight game with Geno Smith at the helm. I know we kind of tipped our hand a little bit, or more than tipped our hand on the Thursday podcast in terms of how we went about investing in this contest. But Payne, which side of the ball are you more fascinated to watch? Jameis Winston against the much maligned Seattle defense, or to see what Geno Smith can do against his second straight top 10 defense, this time in the New Orleans Saints?
Yeah, you mentioned tipping the hand Thursday, and I think the goal here is hopefully that bet coming in for our listeners, because this was not the greatest weekend, and it's not one that you would expect to unfold when the two games you give out beat the closing line by a combined 6 points. You know, yesterday's Eagles game, give out 3, closed 1, -1 at Pinnacle, a 4-point adjustment. Temple closed 1, we gave out 3. So 6 points in our favor. And then obviously we gave this first half total out on the Thursday podcast. You got 21.5 under 20 or 21. And, you know, we're sitting here again at Monday night. As we told you, this line was going to be on the move. You're now looking at like 20.2. So you're below that key number. There's a couple shops out your way, Todd, that are still dangling 21. Would envision those disappear maybe even before this podcast eventually goes live. This is kind of the handicap there. And I don't know if we need to dig into a deep breakdown of both sides of the ball, but basically what you had in this handicap was a Saints offense that is really slow paced, especially to start games, 29th in first half pace. And it is abundantly clear that Sean Payton wanted to kind of rein in Jameis Winston. And I don't know if that was necessarily the right approach. I think if you could have minimized some of the interceptions and not taken away his effectiveness, that would have been the right approach. But the game plans have been super conservative. Now, maybe things change a little bit off the bye, right? You come up with something that's a little bit more sophisticated. You're happy that your offensive line's a little bit more intact. I believe McCoy and Armstead return tonight. So you do get those reinforcements on the offensive line. Or maybe you just say, hey, we have those reinforcements. Now we can run the ball a little bit more. And that's really what New Orleans has been. 49% run in the first halves of games. That conservative nature is why the Saints are 30th in explosive play offense. So basically from the Saints' direction, you have a slow-paced team that's running the ball a lot and not hitting explosives over the top. That is your first recipe for an under. Seattle is middle of the pack in first half pace, but if they've played much slower in the last few weeks, and they've played a lot slower with Geno under center last week. And then when Seattle found success in the second half against Pittsburgh, it was pretty much predicated on their ground game. So my feeling is, just based upon Pete Carroll, he's going to see that success of running in the second half and be like, that's how we need to start this game. And that's really not the recipe against a Saints defense. It's been very stout against the run. The corner situation, I think, for New Orleans is much improved. You're getting Lattimore playing back to his old level. You made the trade for Roby to solidify that unit. And if by chance Seattle is able to drive the ball, you have a Saints defense that has allowed the lowest red zone touchdown rate in the entire league. And then you also have two ridiculous punters in this game that can completely
punter talk the field. This is the first time all season We've got punter talk. I love where we're going with this.
As you know, if you get that 3-and-out after Seattle decided to run the ball in first down, second down, and third down, and it's, you know, 3rd and 1, and you're punting from your own 28, you know, you have Michael Dixon who can boom the ball, and you have a New Orleans punter and Blake Gillikin who is like one of the best punters in the league already. And to top it all off, it looks like there is some weather in the forecast. So that's going to, by nature, I think, have two teams that have played very conservatively do so even more here. And That's why we went under 21.5 in this game. And it's why this game is now, again, like 20.2. I don't know where it's going to go from here. I liked this game. And you know, this will be an interesting kind of glimpse into what we do, Todd, and why, you know, if you're a sports bettor that's starting out and you kind of get down on yourself about making mistakes, like realize that professional bettors do as well. Sunday Night Football. So much is said on this podcast. I really liked the over. In fact, over 44 was going to be one of the investments I made. And then you sit here and you look at the weather come in, and it's supposed to be one of the worst weather games that we've had all season. You talk to some of the groups that you exchange information with and some of the other sharper bettors, and you're like, I can't go over. And I know where this market's heading. Right? And it headed exactly the direction we all knew it would head. And certainly it's the first half under that we played, Todd, you and I, in the 49ers game last night, gets there if Deebo Samuel doesn't fumble with 2.5 minutes to go in the
half. Just hang onto the ball and go down short of the sticks, Deebo. My God.
Right. It's still a winner. But the point is, you had all of that weather, and it was a game that you actually liked over based upon some of the matchups, and it still goes over with all of that weather. So that was one of like the frustrating losses. But you know, the point is, like, there is weather in this game, but this isn't just a weather play, right? There's fundamentally things here within the matchup that scream under as well, and that would be the difference between Monday Night Football and Sunday Night Football for me.
The worst part about that game, Payne, we were texting, of course, midway through the second quarter, and I had to ask you because I hadn't trusted my eyes after the weekend I'd had at the window, going, is this weather getting worse or is it just me? The players, you can barely see through it. You're seeing three and outs. So I decide, in all my infinite glory, it's a great idea to compound a bet that, you know, I thought was a loser in the first half. Well, ultimately, we were going to have a chance if Deebo doesn't fumble. I go under 47.5 live and think, man, we're going to have a chance not only to cash the first half, I'm going to have a great number going to the second half. Do have a great number when the second half total opens 20. Didn't watch the final 5 to 6 minutes of it as I was at the Golden Knights hockey game instead. Check my phone late and find out on a 3rd and 10 from the 28-yard line, Michael Pittman has another jump ball conversion. Game falls 48, under 47.5 live loses. So that was my betting weekend in a microcosm.
Interesting. I had no idea you bet the live under. I'm like a detective when you and I speak via text sometimes. I start to infer that, like, and kind of gather based upon the questions you're asking me what you're actually doing. And so when you asked me that question, I said to myself, there's no doubt he's betting the live under here, even though he's not telling me he's betting
much
the live
smaller,
under here.
Much smaller positions. And the way that I'd buried myself over the course of the weekend, I didn't want to try and bring anybody else down with me. So I had to try and check, poked around, saw some shops that I respect at 45.5, found a rogue 47.5 out here in the desert, and figured, you know what, we'll dabble a little bit. You know what? It didn't quite work out for me. And either way, like we joke about it.
You caught a lifeline too, by the way. I don't know if you knew this or not, but prior to the touchdown there on the 3rd and 10 jump ball to Pittman, Xavier Rhodes intercepted a ball and returned it for a touchdown. And then they reviewed it and he was like, oh my God, his heel just slightly went out. So that was like...
Yeah, I probably didn't deserve it then.
A wide range of emotions had you not been watching... Or at a hockey game, rather than watching the game, because you had the interception touchdown with the, you're probably saying, you know, F me. And then you got the lifeline and it's 3rd and 10 and all you have to do is get off the field and then the jump ball happens.
Oh, sometimes you have to laugh at your own misfortune in this particular business just to try and keep your sanity. But either way, we'll get the first half under tonight. We'll use that as a jumping off point for our listeners as well, and continue to move this train on down the tracks with more college football. And of course, a marquee game Thursday night between the Packers and Cardinals. If you haven't already done so, FanDuel.com/bet the board. Take advantage of all of the generous new user sign-up promotions that they're offering, from a variety of 30-to-1 odds propositions, risk-free bets. There is plenty of ammunition there. And for all our friends in Arizona who may not be with FanDuel, the state of Connecticut, and a variety of other spots, by all means, take advantage. Add FanDuel to your already growing sportsbook arsenal. Any final words of wisdom, life advice you'd like to impart, Payne, before we take a 48-hour break? And we're right back here breaking down college football Wednesday morning.
That is it.
All righty.
Out of Dodge.
Oh, I cut you off.
No, that's it. Out of Dodge.
Okay, out of Dodge it is. For Pain Insider, you can follow him on Twitter at Pain Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there. And, of course, follow the podcast at Bet the Board Pod. Best of luck with all of your investments this fine Monday evening. And hopefully we'll see you at the window.
Thanks for listening to Bet the Board. You can catch Todd and Payne every Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday during football season, breaking down the biggest NFL and college football games. And to make sure you don't miss any free best bets, subscribe to Bet the Board on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.